So welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. I'm Jeffrey Higgins. Good to have everybody here. Elaine's is my wife Cynthia's restaurant. It's Alexandrian cuisine based on her family's recipes from Alexandria, Egypt. And we've turned it into a literary salon, which is a hub for writers in the D.C. area. You are number 187 since I've opened 3 years ago. So this will be a lot of fun. If you're a writer, you know a writer, please reach out to us and we can schedule a time to do an interview with you because we really like to be that safe place for authors. We're also doing a lot of writing workshops and things. Hope Gibbs is our marketing director over here and she's been helping to schedule a lot of these new ventures that we're doing with writers in the whole space around the D.C. area. So Elizabeth Hodges is an aspiring new author dedicated to helping mothers navigate cancer's toughest challenges with strength and purpose. In her compelling debut book, she shares the hard-won lessons she learned while battling leukemia, adult cystic fibrosis for over 18 years, all while raising three young daughters. Through her journey, Elizabeth discovered how to balance motherhood with personal adversity, prioritize what truly mattered, advocate for her health, and find clarity in chaos. Now she's passionate about empowering other moms to face their struggles with courage and unwavering determination. As an accomplished global advertising and marketing executive, Elizabeth spent her early career working for Fortune 500 companies like Ogilvy and Mather, GlaxoSmithKline. After experiencing her life-changing diagnosis, Elizabeth shifted her focus to nonprofit work in the arts, global public health, and education. Now she's an advocate and writer, using her experiences to inspire other mothers navigating cancer's hard road. Elizabeth and her husband split their time between England and Florida, where she continues to write and share her story. So please welcome Elizabeth Hodges. So nice to have you here, and you've come a long way for this one.
I have come. It's an honor.
Are you still jet lagged as we do this interview?
I've been in the United States for about 3 weeks now,
okay.
So I'm adjusted. Adjusted, but I do go back to England tomorrow. So
fantastic! Yeah. I was a guest on a podcast in the UK yesterday.
So now you're tired.
We're crossing the Atlantic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, ships passing in the night.
So this is a really cool book.
Thank you.
I love these books that have a purpose and a mission. Why don't you tell everybody a little bit about who it is, because we're recording this for the podcast as well.
Sure. So I Can Have Cancer, I Have Carpool, Lessons on Beating Cancer While Being a Mom is literally the genesis for the idea came out of a thought that I had one day shortly after I was diagnosed with cancer. Basically, the book shares the lessons that I learned over 20 years raising my daughters from preschool all the way through high school after I was diagnosed with chronic myelogenous leukemia and adult cystic fibrosis when my twins were 2 and my daughter was 6. And so in this book, I share the lessons, like I said, that I learned on parenting through that time. And I want mothers to feel less alone when they are on their own journey and experiencing this themselves. And I'm hoping that they can find strength in the lessons that I share and learn how to keep going and keep moving forward despite what feels like the most devastating time in your life.
When you were diagnosed, did you look for a book like this?
I didn't, because frankly, I remember looking, 20 years ago, I remember looking on the internet and there weren't a lot of books. There weren't a lot of resources for recently diagnosed mothers. And I don't know that at the time I thought, I'm going to write a book based on that. But I do remember looking and there was kind of a dearth of information on, where can I turn to get some information on how to parent through battling cancer? And I distinctly remember there weren't a lot of books. There weren't.
So
now there are. There are more.
There's patient advocates. Right. There's a lot of different avenues people could take to get information. But in that kind of niche area about now that you have this, because it's all about the disease, right? Now,
Yeah. Now,
how do you handle your children? Is there still much about that, about parenting with disease?
So that's one thing I've been really happy to see over the last 20 years is there has been a growth, especially online resources for parents who have been diagnosed and how to help their children through this time. There are specific websites that I have found. Bright Spot Network is one of those that I've been really in awe of their work. So there are now more nonprofits that have come on board, online resources that you can find. And then also a lot of cancer centers throughout the United States, oncology offices, they've realized this is an area where we need to help parents and how to parent and raise their children during this challenging time. And so I'm happy to see that that is an area that has evolved over the last 20 years, definitely.
So your book's a personal narrative about this. Mm-hmm. How much more do you think that helps when people are going through this can hear somebody's personal story versus more clinical facts about what they're going through or like general like parenting philosophy?
You know, you are inundated when you are first diagnosed with cancer. You are inundated with facts and data and scientific information that can truly feel overwhelming. And what I wanted to do with this book was to kind of boil it down to there's the scientific side and then there's the personal side of what you're facing and trying to parent through your cancer diagnosis. And so what I do in my book is I actually, as I present each of the lessons that I've learned over the last 20 years, is I take a personal vignette of something that happened to me and I extract the lesson from that. And what I think that helps is to personalize the experience. So rather than just presenting a list of consider this, consider that, I give these little vignettes of how it happened to me and what I learned from that.
You mentioned having this idea while you're going through cancer, but it's now 20 years. So how long after you were cancer-free did you decide to write this book?
Well, I'm actually still not cancer-free. No. I am in deep remission, okay. But I have been for a number of years. I decided to write the book. I mean, the title of the book, I Can't Have Cancer, I Have Carpal. I should probably back up and explain that a little bit. Literally, the title came from, it was about a month after my diagnosis. And I was standing in my kitchen, standing over the sink, peeling an orange, just staring out the window, watching the trees. And I had stepped away from my laptop for a minute where I had once again obsessively been looking for the magic bullet, the cure that was going to show me that I was going to live long enough to see my children graduate, marry, et cetera. And that was an extremely stressful time. And I had stepped away from my laptop and I was peeling this orange and I casually looked down at my watch and it said, and it was 2:15. And suddenly I realized it was that time. That was my day to kind of begin assisting with the neighborhood carpool again. I had kind of relinquished the effort for about a month to 6 weeks. And I had finally re-engaged and I said, I will do it. We had a neighborhood carpool to take all the children home. And I remember it was 2:15. I remember thought, oh no, I'm late. I was already late to pick up the kids. And as I ran to grab my keys, I remember having this lucid thought. I thought to myself, I can't have cancer. I have carpool. And I realized in that moment that motherhood could be for me a way for me to focus on something that I could do, something that I could control, something that could help kind of rein in the chaos that I had been experiencing. And there's nothing better to divert your attention when I was looking for what could help me not think about cancer all the time was my children in front of me. And it was in that moment that I knew motherhood was what was going to carry me through. I knew that if I focused on what I could do, then that was going to help me feel more in control. I didn't know at that moment that I was going to write the book, but I do remember thinking that could be a good title. But I didn't actually start writing the book until probably about 7 or 8 years in. I really needed to achieve a deep state of remission before I felt comfortable. And then I finished the book kind of during COVID. But what I'm proud about is that I have, you know, from preschool through high school, I have this range of raising my children during that time.
You mentioned, you know, that you're thinking about this, you're looking, you have your laptop out. Like it sounds like it's all consuming, right? When you have a life-threatening disease.
Absolutely.
So like how much does that affect, or how much do you realize at the time that it affects like your cognitive processes, right? Like how hard is it to think clearly or to focus, or how forgetful are you just because you're so overwhelmed with this crisis that's happening?
Initially, you are completely overwhelmed. And I write about that. That's actually the first chapter of the book. Initially, you are completely overwhelmed. You're in a fog. You can't think of anything clearly. I talk about how I can remember the earliest moments in the hospital and a lot of those clear details, but everything after that for the next several months, I have no clear memory of. And so initially, it completely takes over your entire thought process. But again, when I kind of made this personal choice to kind of turn toward motherhood as a sense of empowerment to help me focus on something besides my cancer, then I began to actually think more clearly because I wasn't constantly focused on scientific data, what my probability chances were, what was going to happen to me. I actually, when I focused my attention, I felt empowered by motherhood at the time. And I actually was able to think more clearly about my disease because I wasn't focused on it 24/7. But initially, it's horrible. That's all you think about. And you don't remember things. You said it well. You don't remember things. And it's a real challenge initially.
It actually reminds me of like a form of PTSD, right? Not just the initial diagnosis, which comes as a shock, but going through all the treatment and the horror of the whole thing. Did you find like there's some parallels to that and how maybe like smells or things will bring back images or memories that you lost?
It's actually a really good point that you bring that up, PTSD, because I remember for about the first 8 months, I was definitely in this fog. And then I turned toward motherhood and I was focused on really, you know, diving into my kids' lives. And I remember I kind of reached a plateau where I felt at peace. I knew I had to get through treatment. I knew it was a step-by-step process. And then I remember about 12 to 18 months later, I remember I did have this PTSD experience where suddenly I literally felt like I kind of came crashing into a wall at 60 miles an hour. And a lot of what I experienced came rushing back. I became down again. I had a hard time focusing and I had to reorient myself and go back to what I knew, which was focusing on my family. But I did have a moment of PTSD. I think that absolutely happens. I don't know that I remember what caused it. I do remember feeling, gosh, I feel like I'm reliving this again. And I was a year in. Yeah.
It's so interesting. So I'm curious, like when you actually, you had some space, you're in this deeper mission. So you're like, okay, now I'm going to write this because people need this book, which I love, right? It's a real mission. When you started writing it, did it bring back a lot of the trauma of the experience?
Writing the lessons themselves actually wasn't traumatic for me because there was information that I wanted to share, right? When I wrote the vignettes that I mentioned earlier about my experiences, I found that to be a very emotional process. Writing what I had experienced and reliving that, whether it was 5, 10, or 15 years ago, I did find that emotional and that often brought me to tears. Yes.
As you were writing it, did you find it desensitized you at all? Like as you're going through, because it takes a while to write a book, right? As you were going through to getting these out and putting them on paper, because people use that journaling as a form of therapy in and of itself. Did you find that or was it just sort of traumatic through the writing?
No, I agree with you. I did get desensitized to the information because the lessons that I talk about, the facts and data that I shared, I wanted mothers to benefit from the information. And so I did become, you kind of do pull yourself out of it and say, what is it that I wanted to convey to these mothers? What did I want to share in my experience? And I was able to step away and really focus on the message. But again, it was only when I wrote the vignettes, the personal things that happened to me, that it was always a bit emotional. Yeah.
So this might be hard to answer. And I don't know if people, I mean, it takes introspection, but I also don't know if anyone can do it. Mm-hmm. What is it in you that makes you take something that was so terrifying for you and for your family and so difficult to go through? I mean, even taking years before you can approach it, that makes you want to put yourself through that again to help other people in the same situation? Like there's an altruistic motivation there, right? Like what is it inside you? Did you see glimmers of this in other parts of your life? Or was this something that is different?
I think it's different because I did have this experience where, unlike many forms of cancer, where you are diagnosed, you go through treatment, you achieve remission. And for many women, fortunately, many mothers, they may never experience their cancer again. Because I have a chronic form of leukemia, I've never been able to put my cancer aside. My diseases live with me every single day. And so as I have been on this journey for the last 20 years, I just felt that I had so much to share over this 20-year journey. And I wanted women to not have the moment that you mentioned earlier where you're sitting in a hospital bed and you want to find a book or something to turn to help you as soon as you're diagnosed. And I had nothing. I wanted women to have that. And I felt like because I had this vast number of years of experience, I could help women feel less alone.
So early in the book, you talk about that moment at the airport when your doctor calls you and you get the news. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's obviously one of the most traumatic parts for everybody, right? Mm-hmm. When they're just snapped out of the regular life. Tell everybody a little bit about how that happened.
So my symptoms from my form of leukemia had been very subtle. A doctor once said to me, cancer's like a snake in the grass. It pops up out of nowhere and bites you. And that was certainly the case for me. My symptoms did not point to anything cancer related. I had been, I had lost weight, but I thought maybe I was working out more than normal. I had had recurring headaches. I thought that was maybe, I literally thought I had developed an allergy to coffee. I thought that somehow suddenly I was allergic to coffee because I was drinking more coffee because I was also
now you're giving me PTSD.
And I was becoming a little bit more fatigued. So, you know, you start to theorize what things could be. And we decided that we were going to go on spring break down to see my parents in Florida. And I had started to see an infectious disease specialist to kind of get to the bottom of some of these strange symptoms that I was having that doctors couldn't pinpoint. And I had seen an infectious disease specialist, and we were with our 2-year-old twins and our 6-year-old, and we were literally in the line to board the plane, and my cell phone rang in my pocket, and I looked down and I saw that it was my doctor. And I assumed that he was calling to tell me, everything is fine. Your blood work looks great. Everything is fine. Enjoy your spring break. And instead, I answered the phone and I said, no matter what you say, I said to my doctor, no matter what you say, we're going to Florida. And he said, where are you? And I said, I'm at the airport. Why? And he said, I need you to get to an emergency room. And I said, why do I? And he said, your blood work has come back and your white blood cell count is off the charts. And I remember somewhere in the recesses of our mind, we all have this thinking, I kind of know that if your white blood cell count is off the charts, that it's potentially leukemia. I don't know how I knew that. And I said, what does this mean? And he said, I think you might have leukemia. And I'm standing in a crowded airport with 2 twins in a stroller and a 6-year-old who's running around, and my husband's in line and he's looking at me and he's waving to me, why, you know, come on, we have to board the plane. Why are you on the phone? And I said, I stepped out of line and I remember I walked up to the window and I stared out and I whispered, almost because I couldn't hear myself say the words, I said to him, did you just say you think I have leukemia? And he said, yes, and I need you to get to an emergency room right now. And so I then had to wave to my husband, you need to get out of line. And, you know, he comes over and I remember the words spilling out of my mouth to saying to my husband, that was the doctor, I need to get to the emergency room. He thinks I might have leukemia. And, you know, of course, everything imploded at that moment, you know, getting the twins in the stroller, the 6-year-old is wondering why we're not getting on the plane. Yeah, it was a surreal moment. And that's an example of something I remember very, very clearly. A lot after that, I don't remember as clearly, but you always remember the moment that somebody tells you they think you have cancer.
So that moment, like that initial shock that you have, mm-hmm. How does that change? Like, what do you go through, like the stages of grief? Like how do you get to that level of acceptance when you're like, you've internalized it, you're over the shock, and now you're like, you know, getting ready to go to battle and fight this thing. Like, how does that happen?
I don't think you actually get to a point where you reach acceptance. And I talk a lot about reaching acceptance in my book and the importance of that, because I believe that reaching acceptance about what you are facing is critically important. I don't think you reach that point of acceptance until you have a very clear understanding of exactly what your disease is. And that can take days, weeks to really clarify exactly what disease you're facing, what your treatment plan is, and what that treatment plan looks like, and the amount of time that it's going to take. And I believe until you have that clear picture, can you really accept, okay, this is what's happening, this is how it's going to go. And then you can start to get to, at least for me, I knew I had to accept it and begin, as you said, gearing up to fight this battle. And then also I had to reach acceptance because I had children and people that were relying on me, mm-hmm. you know, and I had to focus my attention elsewhere.
So to what extent is like that unknown where you don't know how bad it is, you don't know what exactly how you're going to treat it, how much of that, like what percentage of that is the fear that you're facing?
That is the most fearful time. When I was first diagnosed, before I knew that I had a chronic form of leukemia, they actually thought that I had a more severe and frankly a more deadly form of acute leukemia. And they did not know that I had a chronic form of my disease until about 3 or 4 days in. So that 3 days when they believed I had an acute form and I was looking it up online and looking in a medical journal, what that road looked very different for me than having a chronic form of the disease. And the fear surrounding that was absolutely, you know, they say there's a saying in the internet, you know, when you're first diagnosed with cancer, they say in the cancer community, when you're first diagnosed, stay away from the internet. And they say that for a reason, because it can be a very scary place to go. And it was very fearful for me in those first few days before I realized I had a chronic form of the disease, which was a dramatically different path than if I had an acute form of leukemia. And the fear was immense.
So do you recommend that people don't like do their own research, or do, or how do you balance like being as a patient, like learning as much as you can so you can participate in your care, as opposed to, but also, you know, using Dr. Google, right? And then seeing all these horrible things that you have no way to look at, and you don't understand how to weigh them.
Yeah. I would definitely say know thyself. I have always been a person who believes information is power. So early on, I was not afraid to know. Once I was the type of leukemia that I had, we knew what it was. The more information I had, the more in control I felt. Even if it was scary, I felt I needed to understand what exactly I had and what that looked like for me going forward. I have met many mothers who did not want to know that, and they turned it over to a spouse, to a friend, to another caregiver, to kind of manage those details, because they just didn't feel that they could handle the truth of maybe what they were facing. You really have to know yourself. I do espouse for information is power and knowing what you can, because I think it makes for your doctor's appointments to be more productive. I think you're able to have a stronger level of care because you are talking with your doctor at a very high level about your disease and your treatment. But that's not for everybody. And it's certainly not for every mother if they are, again, having to also care for their family at the same time. So know thyself. But I chose the route of more information was better for me. Even if it was scary, even if it was frightening, I still wanted to know.
So you mentioned, like, you know, calling your husband over at the airport, right? Mm-hmm. And you have to give them the news. Mm-hmm. How do you, like, when you're researching and when you're learning things about the disease, or you're getting news from your doctor, or you're looking at potentially very bad possibilities, mm-hmm. how do you balance how much of that you share with family? And I'm not talking about the kids now, but like your husband or mm-hmm. friends or whatever, versus keeping some of that to yourself until you know for sure.
Yeah, that's another area where we knew exactly what my disease was, we were not sharing with anyone kind of outside of our immediate family, because we weren't quite certain what we were dealing with. And then once we did, because I had young children, the school factor quickly comes into play, because suddenly the school has to be aware that there's this traumatic thing going on at home. So people found out about the type of cancer that I had very early on because, again, my children were young. Teachers needed to know. Again, that is a personal choice. Many mothers decide that they are going to keep it all within the family. They do not want anyone to know. They don't even want the school to know. I made a decision that I wanted as many people to help us as possible. And I wanted teachers to kind of form a protective, you know, shell around my children. And when they were at school, they didn't know that anything was wrong at home. So it's a personal choice. That is also a personal choice. How much do you want to share with people? If you're a working professional, how much do you want work to know what you are experiencing? I made a decision that people knew my story. It was hard to avoid, again, because my children were younger. Sometimes I did wish I hadn't shared as much as I did, because I was constantly having to answer questions. Sometimes people I barely knew were coming up to me in the grocery store and asking, you know, how I was doing and how my treatment was going. And that became exhausting over time, having to kind of repeat that over and over. But you don't know that until you learn. But it's definitely a personal decision. And I talk about that in the book.
What about the, like, expression of sympathy from other people when they've learned and they're trying to be kind or be empathetic, right? And there was that helpful to you? Or is that the kind of thing that drags you back into it or makes it harder to actually put it out of your mind so you can go about your day?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I found actually the phrase, this is for me, but I do write about it. The phrase for me that I found hardest to hear, if you can believe it, is I'm so sorry. When people said, I'm so sorry, for some reason, it struck me in a very different way because it felt when they said, I'm so sorry, I felt almost powerless as if they felt sorry for me that almost there was nothing that I was going to be able to do. And I didn't like hearing that. That doesn't say anything about the people who said that to me. They were saying that from a very loving, empathetic, caring place. But for me, for some reason, every time I heard that, I'm so sorry, I just thought, well, I don't feel sorry for myself. You know, I'm fighting this thing. Everybody kind of does have their phrase that they hear that kind of gets under their skin. I found the most effective phrase that somebody said to me soon after I was diagnosed. I was on the phone with a friend of mine, and he said to me, you must feel like you're on a roller coaster. And I remember when he said that to me, I was pushing a gurney down the hospital hallway. And I remember thinking, that's exactly how I feel. One moment I felt that I was rising and I was going to survive this and I was going to be okay. And then the next moment I was plunging down, depressed. Am I going to live to see my children grow up? And then I would get good news. And so now I use that phrase all the time. When I hear people are going through a health crisis, I say to them, you must feel like you're on a roller coaster. And I'm amazed how often people say, that's exactly how I feel.
So what type of conversation with like friends or family is helpful? Do you like the more worried about your psychological well-being or people like just being emotionally there for you? Or do you prefer conversations where people are like, what can I like tangibly do for you? What concrete measures can I do? You know, what was it that you found? I'm sure it's very individual, but what did you find that was most helpful?
You know, the initial conversations with friends when they were offering, you know, offers of help to help with the family, I didn't want to manage any of that. I didn't want to manage what casserole somebody was bringing over. Again, it was so very generous, but I just didn't have the mental bandwidth to kind of manage those types of details. But I remember soon after that I didn't want people to feel uncomfortable around me if they wanted to talk to me about my disease. And I remember early on, you know, saying to people, feel free to ask me anything, because I sometimes noticed that when people felt uncomfortable, it made you feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the details about right after I was diagnosed, I kind of farmed that out to my husband and friends. But if people wanted to talk to me in detail when I started seeing friends again, I didn't have a problem with that. But I think that comes back to information for me was power. I was not afraid of talking about my medical diagnosis. But again, that is a very personal decision. And I'm sure for a lot of mothers, yes, it generates a lot of emotion that they don't want to have to relive again and again. And I think you have to learn how to say to friends what you are comfortable talking about and what you are not comfortable talking about. And I think that's fair. I think as a cancer survivor, you have every right to say that.
So let's talk about your kids. So you have something that's potentially fatal, right? Mm-hmm. How much do you share with your kids? You said six and twins who are two. Uh-huh. So these are very different ages. Tell us how you approached it.
Well, the twins were obviously too young at 2 years old. They were too young to understand anything. So I don't even remember if we said one. I don't recall if we even said one word to the twins. My oldest at the time was six. And I think we couched it in terms of mom is sick. She has something. She did nothing to, this is not her fault. It is not contagious. It's not something that you will get. We kind of spoke in very kind of broad terms. I write about in the book how to talk to kids at different ages about your diagnosis, how to talk to preschoolers, kids in elementary school, middle school, and high school. And that's a very, as you can imagine, that's a very different conversation depending on the age of your children. And there's a lot that you have to take into consideration, no matter what age. So was I fortunate that my kids were younger and I didn't have to have harder conversations versus if I had a kid in high school? Yes, that conversation for me was a little bit easier. But I do talk about the different ways and the things that you need to think about depending on the age of your child and how to talk about it. And the resources that you can turn to help you with that process. Because again, over the last several years, more and more has come out about how to talk to children when you are diagnosed.
So how do you weigh, when you're very sick, like how do you weigh talking to maybe a six-year-old or say someone older, 15 mm-hmm. or, you know, how do you weigh talking to them about the very real possibilities, the bad outcomes that could happen versus ignoring that and just helping them through the day-to-day when you're not there, when you're undergoing treatment?
Yeah, that's a good question. Because I made this conscious decision to kind of turn towards motherhood as this kind of this empowerment source of strength to kind of help me through my journey, I didn't turn to what was any potential outcome. Because the reality was for my cancer and for many cancers, you don't know what the outcome is going to be for quite a long time. You have to go through treatment. You have to see how you respond to treatment. You have follow-up for years to come. So I would say rarely do you actually have to talk to your children about this is exactly what's going to happen because you don't even know. So we never kind of went there with my six-year-old. But I think that certain types of cancers, you do have to have those conversations. And I do suggest in my book, always, always recommending talking to social workers that are available at every oncology office, cancer centers, talking with therapists and speaking with a professional before you talk to your children about what your disease and what it looks like. I definitely recommend that. I didn't have to do that again because my children were younger, but I definitely recommend you bring in other sources to help you before you talk to your children if they're of a certain age, because those conversations can be scary and they might ask those difficult questions. They definitely might ask those difficult questions. What's going to happen to you? And how do you approach that subject?
So how do you approach it with a six-year-old? If your six-year-old naturally would say something like, are you going to die or what's going to happen? Or how? What would you say then? Do you couch it in different terms to make not terrify them?
Yeah. I mean, you obviously, yes, you are very focused on how do you not scare your child. I did not know at the time what the outcome for me was going to be. So I wasn't worried because I didn't have to kind of go there and talk about it. And fortunately for me, my oldest did not bring that up. She did not, you know, flat out come out and say, mommy, are you going to die? As children get older, that, you know, that question does get asked, what's going to happen to you? And again, there, depending on the age, honesty is always the best policy, you know, and not hiding what could then change and that could become more traumatic for the family. But again, I strongly recommend speak to a professional first, maybe role play with someone before you have this conversation with your child and prepare yourself for the potential that you could get that question. I was very lucky, my six-year-old, she just never went there. She never asked that question.
So boys and girls, you know, develop at different stages. Mm-hmm. Is there a difference in ages based on whether it's a male or female child? Have you seen any of this data?
Yes, I have. I have seen that boys tend to, research shows that when boys find out that their mother has cancer, they tend to withdraw more. Boys also can then go in the opposite direction and they tend to act out more. So they might start misbehaving more at school or in social settings as kind of their way to react to what is happening to their mother. Girls do tend to ask more questions and want to know more. And girls, there is research that shows girls tend to be much more protective of their mother and they might want to help their mother more at home. They might actually withdraw from their friends because they feel like they need to be home helping mom. So yes, there is data out there about the different ways that boys and girls at different ages, the various ways that they respond. But I will definitely say that that is just, you know, that's general data. What you experience in your own family is, it is a highly personal experience. And you don't know until you are going through it.
So I'm curious about like going through treatment mm-hmm. and how that affects the family and especially your kids. I mean, you don't have to go into specifics about your types of treatment or anything, but I'm sure there's times when you're away from home. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that.
You know, I always kind of joke around that my daughter's watched way more Disney movies than probably any, you know, child should, because a lot of times after I had either been to a doctor's appointment or I still do take an oral chemo every single day and I was starting my oral chemo and I was getting used to the side effects. And I was having, you know, side effects that made me very tired. Yeah, I needed to go lay down. I needed to rest. I needed to take care of myself. And yeah, I would, you know, let my kids watch a movie. There is, I talk about, however, that those don't necessarily have to be bad experiences in your cancer journey. I often laid on the couch with my girls and watched those movies. And so, and I didn't do it because I enjoyed Disney movies. I did it because at least I was in the same room with my girls. I could still be with them. I didn't go off and kind of sit in my bedroom and cry, or I thought, well, I'm just going to sit here and just being with them. Because one of the things I talk about in my book is even though you have cancer, you can still give to your children even when you are ill and not feeling well. And what people don't understand is that your children will take whatever you can give them. So if that's 1% of you, 5% of you, or 20%, your children take that and they are thankful for it. And you don't have to be 100% for your children when you're going through cancer. And so that's what I did. If I could only give my kids 1% and I laid on the couch and watched a movie, that meant a lot to me and my girls were glad to have me there. And so you find those things, those ways, when you turn to motherhood as kind of your source of strength and empowerment, you find those ways to be with your children even when you are not feeling well and you're not at your best during cancer treatment.
Did they, because you didn't tell them everything, did they have moments when they were like wondering why you weren't doing something for them or weren't able to do something? Like, I wonder, it just seems natural that you would get those moments and maybe you're even feeling guilty because you can't do certain things, but you can't because you're saving yourself for them.
That's exactly it. And there's a lot, you know, I talk about there's this guilt sometimes that you feel that you're not feeling good and you can't give as much to your kids as you would like, or you have to farm out carpool, or you have to have other people help you because yes, you have to go for treatment. And that was hard for me. I think it's hard for any mother because you want to be there for your children and sometimes you just can't. And yeah, there were definitely moments in the journey when, you know, the kids kind of forget that mom is sick and they are maybe pushing your buttons a little bit. And you know, that was hard too. But again, you learn how to navigate that. And I learned how to be honest with my children and say, I'm not feeling really well right now. I've got to go upstairs for a moment. And my kids learned over the course of many years that when I said, I'm not feeling great right now, I'm going to go upstairs. They knew what was going on. And I think most children, when their mothers are going through cancer treatment, they too develop that awareness and understanding and they can, you know, accept that their mom needs a break.
So you did a lot of research, you've mm-hmm. experienced this personally, but you also had to kind of find your own path, right? Through a lot of this. Are there things in your research that you found that other people do that they shouldn't? Are there mistakes, common mistakes that a parent with cancer is doing that maybe they should try to avoid?
No, I would say that every mother's journey is individualistic and every mother is going to find eventually her own path. I wrote this book because I wanted to help give some lessons that they could maybe consider while they're going through their cancer journey. But it is really, truly an individual journey for each and every mother. I know for me that cancer taught me a lot of great life lessons. You know, I am often thankful for the gift, the things that cancer did give to me. And the only thing I would say to a mother is not so much, don't do this. I would say to a mother, let cancer teach you some very valuable life lessons and learn from what cancer does gift to you, which is the realization that you only live once, you know, truly find your passion, do what you love, take risk, enjoy life. I would say versus don't do this, I would say let cancer teach you its very valuable lessons.
See, I mean, those are really valuable. And you mentioned this reordering of priorities. Mm. When does that happen? Or when for you did that happen in that process? When, because you're, you know, obviously there's very different moments. At one point, did you say, okay, I have to reprioritize and change what I'm doing with the time I have?
Not until, I can honestly say for me, it wasn't until I was in deep remission and I knew, okay, my path forward looks, I don't know that I would say secure, but when I was in deep remission, I was able to kind of say, okay, now I can kind of step back and what do I really want to do with my life? I changed where I was working professionally. I changed my focus, things that I was interested in, passions that I had. I really reoriented my life toward those things. I changed how I spent my time. I said no to more things, and I spent more time with my family and was very focused. But I didn't reach that point until I had achieved a level of remission where I could feel comfortable of, okay, I don't have to focus on this as much as I was. I can start to look back at my life and really reorient. You know, that's how it was for me. And I think that's true for a lot of women. You know, again, different types of cancers, you're diagnosed, you go through treatment, you reach remission. That's kind of when you get that clarity back, because during that time, you're so focused on going through treatment.
When you sat down to write this, because you knew you wanted to give a roadmap for people, a roadmap you didn't have, was there a moment when you started writing this and you're like, why am I doing this and putting myself through this again? Or were you so driven by the mission that it kind of pulled you through, or both?
Yeah, I did have that moment. I did have that moment of, is anybody, you know, why am I writing this? You know, is anybody going to care? Is this really going to be helpful? I think that's the thought that I, you know, because I knew these were the lessons that I learned in using motherhood as a source of strength to, you know, help me get me through my cancer experience. But I did have those moments of, are other women going to find this valuable? What has been so rewarding since my book has launched is I am hearing back from women that, wow, the lessons that you talk about are so helpful. And that's incredibly rewarding. But yes, there were definitely moments when I thought, is this going to matter to other mothers? Because this was just my personal experience. And then what I have found is that so many women have played back, that was my experience also. And so your book has been helpful for me.
How do you feel when you read that? You get some feedback from someone and you've actually made their experience a little better, or and for their kids too.
It's the most rewarding part of writing, that has been the most rewarding part of writing this book, is hearing. I always said to myself, if my book can help one mother, if I help just one mother on her cancer journey, I will be happy. And now that I've heard from numerous women that my book is very helpful, I heard from a mother recently who shared with me that she was down. She had been recently diagnosed. I sent her a free copy of my book and she wrote me a handwritten thank you note. And she said, you have re-energized me. You have given me hope. You have given me a new way for me to view my experience and how I can use motherhood and focus on my kids. And that really was so rewarding. And so just knowing that I've helped mothers in this way, when, yes, I was definitely not sure if my book was going to matter to anyone. And it does. And that makes you really happy.
Did you tell anyone when you were writing it, or did you do it privately?
I wrote it. It was private. My husband knew. I maybe told a few people. It took me a long time to write my book because I was, you know, as I mentioned, my children were in preschool. And when I finished the book, they had just graduated from high school. So I wrote it for a very long time, too long. I wrote it for a very long time over a very long period of time. So nobody wanted to hear for 18 years, oh, you're still writing your book. So I kind of kept it quiet. And then when I got to the point where it was going to be published, then I told more people.
I mean, there is no too long, right? People write it over decades. Some people write a book in months. I mean, it's different for everybody.
Absolutely.
But you're in that 1% who actually finishes a book. So that's a really big deal. You know, it's because it's a different kind of book. When it came out, like a lot of debut authors, when their book comes out and they're so excited and looking to have this book, but also it's about this really difficult time in your life and it's about really, you know, heady topics. What was the feeling like when you finished this thing and you received the book?
You know, you kind of can't believe that you have scaled the mountain, because that's literally what it felt like many times for me when I was writing this book, especially toward the end. You really felt like you were just trying to reach the summit of a mountain. And when you get to the top of the mountain, and then when you receive the book and it arrives in the mail, you really feel like you've achieved something, as if you have conquered a mountain. And that is incredibly satisfying. Because I would definitely say toward the end of the process, I didn't know if I was going to reach the summit. There were times when I thought, am I ever going to see this thing through? And when you finally, you know, again, it arrives in the mail, it's surreal.
What did you do to teach yourself how to write? because you're writing in the first person, you're writing narrative, you know, you're writing these vignettes that you talked about. So you're using like the fiction techniques. Mm-hmm. You know, how did you learn to do that?
I didn't necessarily learn. I just knew that I wanted to use this vignette lesson format. So because I told personal stories about myself and the lessons that I learned from that, that kind of just naturally dictated the way, the tone that I wrote, because I started with the vignette and then the lessons. I knew what I wanted to communicate, but I knew, again, as I stated earlier, I couldn't just present a list of things that I had learned. I knew I had to personalize it so that another mother could understand what I had been through and they could relate to it. And so that kind of just by default dictated how I wrote in this manner. It just kind of fueled itself.
So I'm curious about your writing practice because, you know, you have health issues. So you have an energy that you have to balance, right? There's only so much energy you can put into different things. Did you write the same time every day? Like how did you do this?
Yeah, I absolutely believe in writing the same time every single day. I absolutely believe that writing, you hear this, writing is a muscle. You have to exercise it. And I did find that writing at the same time every single day, and you develop a habit over time when you do it every day. Literally, when that time of day comes, I tended to write in the late afternoon, right around 4 o'clock was my sweet spot. And you can start to feel your body and your brain starts to get into that mindset. Another thing that I did, my writing practice was, there was a certain piece of music actually from the movie Gladiator that somebody, a book architect friend of mine said, try listening to this music. And if you could believe it, I listened to the same soundtrack from The Gladiator for months and months and months. And I thought that would drive me crazy when he suggested this, but that also, the minute my brain heard that music, that was another way that I would immediately get into the writing mode. So it was a certain time of day, and then it was a certain type of music that I listened to, and I was able to get right in the groove of writing.
That's very common, by the way. Like people listening to the same soundtrack or pairing soundtracks to a particular book.
I had never heard of it.
Yeah, and it triggers your mind, right? As soon as you hear it, I'm in writing mode now.
Yeah.
Where did you write?
I always wrote in my bedroom, on a laptop in my bedroom. And it was, I lived in different, over the course of 20 years, I lived in different locations. I wrote during COVID. I wrote a lot during COVID. And so I always tended to take my laptop, put it, a desk in a bedroom, close the door, and I needed that real distance from the rest of the family, the rest of the house. That was what helped me the most.
So writers have all these options to publish now. You can self-publish, there's hybrids or traditional press or small presses and big five, right? You can go for an agent. Tell us a little bit about your journey with this and why you went in that direction.
I originally thought that I was going to self-publish my book because it seems so easy. And then when I got into investigating, how to self-publish, I realized I became very afraid that I was going to make a mistake. I was afraid that I would get the number, I would make a mistake. And so somehow when it was eventually online, something would be wrong. And I just didn't want to take that risk. So then I chose a publishing house that I knew in Atlanta, which is where I lived at the time. I had heard about it through a friend. And they offer, as many publishing houses do, they offer these kind of packages to, they take your book and they just kind of, they walk you through the whole process. So for a fee, they will walk you through this process and help you get your book online. And they offer, and then it's kind of a menu. For me, I needed that. I needed that level of expertise. I was not a writer. My prior professional history was not a writer. I didn't have any experience in the literary world. And so I wanted that assistance from a publishing house. But many people self-publish, and it's just your choice what you feel most comfortable with. And I would say carefully consider what you are most comfortable with, because it will matter, because there's a lot of work at the end getting your book online and out there.
And what was the editing process with your publisher? Like, how many iterations did you go through? What kind of notes were you getting back?
So the editing process, you write the book and then you think you're done. And then you have to edit your book, which is a whole other mountain to climb. And I could not believe how challenging I found the editing process, because you work with an editor who, you hear all the time, they slash a lot of, and you need to edit your book. you don't want to edit your book because you've written it and you're like, it's done, right? It's done. Editing, I believe, is the most important part of the entire process. And you have to be ruthless at that stage. And I encourage every writer to find the best possible editor or editors. So I had editors at the publishing house. And then I also had a very dear friend who was an editor. And so I worked with a number of people. So I was getting feedback from both the publisher and another editor friend that I worked with. And I hated the process. I wanted to be done with the book, but I knew that that was the most important step in the process. I just knew it. And so I pushed through.
What was the most surprising part of either the writing or the publishing, the business side of this, that things are something you hadn't expected? Because, you know, a lot of people think, oh, I'll just write a book. Like you said, it'll be easy, right? I'll publish it. It'll be super easy.
There's writing the book, and then there's getting the book out there and getting the book, you know, generating awareness and marketing the book. And I don't think I ever appreciated that how much work it would take to market your book and get people to actually buy it.
Well, there are 5 million books that came out in 2025. So trying to get attention on your book is really hard. Have you found anything that works, or have you found anything that doesn't?
What I have talked to people about as well was, is there's nothing that you shouldn't, there's nothing you shouldn't consider. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that my publisher said to me was, she said, don't look at your competitors in your book space as competitors. If there is another person that's written a book similar to yours, reach out to them and do an event or talk with them, because their readers can become your readers. And that was, it makes such sense. Mm-hmm. But who would have ever have thought, befriend your competitor, you know, befriend the person that's written something very similar to you, but they have a whole different set of readers. And so you might as well join together and work to grow your audience together versus just trying to do it all on your own. That was incredibly enlightening. People that have written books that have similar, you know, it might not even be in the same genre, but you can find things in their genre that you can maybe, you know, do a talk with them, and they can find something in your book, and you'd be surprised how many similar themes. Again, you're reaching a whole different audience. And that's what is the ultimate, I think, driver of book sales, is constantly finding new audiences for your book. You obviously have to fish where the fish are and go to, you know, mothers with cancer, obviously, but, you know, a lot of caregivers could be interested in my book because I share a lot of tips for caregivers, or a caregiver might want to give this to a mother who has cancer. And so I have to just constantly find different audiences. And that's the way your book stays active and how you just keep, you know, getting your book out there.
Are you writing something else now?
You know, it's funny. I was talking about this earlier. I do have an idea for a second book. I do. I have not started writing it. I have jotted notes. You know what takes to go into the first book, and you know the work that it entails. And so I need to get started, but I do have another book idea in mind. Yes.
You'll be faster this time.
Oh, I hope. I hope. 18 years. I hope I'm faster this time. Yeah.
Do we have any questions in the audience? Anything you'd like to ask her while she's on the spot? So it's during COVID, was that generating extra fear for somebody with cancer?
Absolutely. What I haven't talked about today a lot is that I was not only diagnosed with chronic myelogenous leukemia, but 6 weeks later, I was diagnosed with adult cystic fibrosis. When they were looking to see if I could be a candidate for a bone marrow transplant to cure me of the acute form of leukemia that I had, they discovered that my lungs were incredibly damaged and they weren't sure why. And so 6 weeks after I was diagnosed with chronic myelogenous leukemia, I was diagnosed with adult CF. Mm. So I was therefore then battling two chronic life-threatening diseases. What that meant for me during COVID was, because it was a respiratory disease, absolutely, I was at greater risk. And so I had to, part of the reason why I wrote so much during COVID is because I literally had to leave my family for a period of time and go stay at my parents' home alone, kind of isolated, because I was very, very high risk. And because I was alone and I had so much time on my hands, well, there was no better time than to continue working on my book, but I was very high risk during COVID. Yes.
Good question. Any other questions? So a cathartic element from the writing that empowered you.
Yes. Finishing this book and kind of getting my story out there. You know, when you write a book, something that's, part memoir, you write it and you finish it and you are kind of giving it to the world, right? It's a very vulnerable moment. You are sharing a lot of personal information and you feel very vulnerable when you first publish a book where you share such personal information. But it was cathartic because I thought to myself, well, I feel that I want this information to help other mothers with cancer. And so it was cathartic because I knew, hopefully, I was going to help other people. So it's this kind of, it's a double-edged sword. You feel vulnerable because you're putting some personal information out there, but it's cathartic that you're hopefully helping other women through your story. And yes, that is very empowering. Sharing your story and hopefully helping others does have a very empowering feeling, absolutely. But it's definitely a double-edged sword.
How does it feel now, talking about such personal things in a public forum?
You quickly get used to, once your book has been out there, you get used to, if you can't be comfortable talking about what's in your book after a period of time, and so now I have absolutely no problems talking about any of the information in my book, going in depth about it, answering questions, because you're also, when you're promoting your book, you are also sharing a lot of that personal information, right? You share what's in the book, and a lot of that is deeply personal. So then you're out on social media sharing more personal information, and you do have to develop kind of a thick skin of, this is what I've got to do to promote the book and to get my message out there to hopefully help other mothers. And you develop a bit of a thick skin. Like, this is part of the process.
All writers have to get that thick skin, right? Yeah. So when you get, I don't know if you've had it, I think you have 5 stars on Amazon, but if somebody says something negative about the book, is it harder to kind of brush it off because this is such a personal book about your story?
I've been fortunate that I've not had any negative reviews, but I've always braced myself for that because not everybody is going to respond to your message. I've often thought that some mothers would say, you maybe make this a little bit too simple for me. My journey has been a lot harder. My cancer journey has been a lot more traumatic for me and my family. And I respect that and I honor that. And I do think that maybe, one day I will hear that from a mother, that my message maybe wasn't the right message for them. And that's okay. Everybody's health journey is different. Every mother's journey with cancer and what she's experiencing is different. So I'm prepared for that and I will respect that. Absolutely.
Okay. So where should readers go to get your book?
My book is available on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. You can get it on Apple Books as an ebook, and also on my website. You can go to my website, ElizabethHodges.com, and click on any button and you can order it right off my website.
And if you haven't done it here, or if you're listening, I recommend you go on and give her a 5-star review to let her, because it really helps with discoverability for authors. And if you like what we're doing with Elaine's Literary Salon, please do that as well. Or rate us on Open Table or Yelp or wherever you rate our restaurants. We'd really appreciate it. And go sign up for ElainesLiterarySalon.com for our newsletter so you can be notified when we have upcoming events. Well, thank you so much. This is really wonderful. And you have books for the people here, correct?
I do.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well done.
Thank you so much.